This is Pro Bono Radio.
Hi, I'm Parnian.
I'm Waylon.
And we are here with William Flanagan, the Dean of the Law School here at Queen's. He's been the Dean here for the past 14 years, and it's actually his last year here, so we're very happy and fortunate to be able to sit down with him. Alongside his research, the Dean has introduced new programs and opportunities here at the Faculty of Law, including the International Law Program, which takes place over the summer at the Castle in England, as well as an undergraduate certificate in law and Legal Services Management Program, which will be starting up this year. So we are going to be sitting down with Dean Flanagan, and we're going to be talking about the public health concerns surrounding those who are HIV positive and how that has informed the evolution of criminalizing the risk of HIV transmission.
So without further ado, here's our interview with the Dean.
Maybe I'll just start with a few thoughts on the topic. So my interest in the topic is primarily from a public health perspective, not so much a criminal law perspective. And I'm not a criminal law expert. So this is when I say, talk to Professor Stewart if you really want a criminal law expert to talk about consent and the content of sexual assault. What I'm more interested in is the public health aspect of HIV. And in particular, I've been involved in a national working group as part of the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research, and I've got a copy of it here for you. And this is a group of a national working group of community people and scientists and experts and so forth. And we put together this proposal on ending the HIV epidemic in Canada in 5 years. And so one of the major proposals that we do in this document is that there's a significant number of people in Canada who remain undiagnosed. That is, they're HIV positive, but they're unaware that they're HIV positive. So there's 14% of the people in Canada who are living with HIV are unaware of their diagnosis, or unaware that they're living with HIV. And this, of course, is the population that we really need to reach in terms of testing and provision of treatment, because we know that if people are on treatment, their risk of transmission is effectively zero. And so this is really the way to end HIV, which is the focal point of what we're doing. So we're very interested in thinking about what are the barriers to testing in Canada? Why are there so many people in Canada who still are unaware? There's over 9,000 people living in Canada right now who are living with HIV but are undiagnosed. This is not only, of course, a serious matter for their personal health because they're not getting the treatment that they need. But we also know that if people are undiagnosed, there's a higher risk of transmission. And, of course, that leads to the criminal law matter.
Correct.
Now, the barriers to testing include a variety of things. One that we really focus on a lot is we want options to increase for self-testing. So in jurisdictions like Germany and in the United States, you can walk into a pharmacy and just like you can get a pregnancy test, you can purchase an HIV test.
Wow.
And it's something you can do at home and determine your status. So we think this is a great idea. This is broadening the options available to testing. And the more people that we can encourage, particularly those at risk, to test, if we can reduce the number of undiagnosed, it's going to have a dramatic impact on new infections in the country, because it's the undiagnosed that are primarily
transmitting.
Yes, exactly, because they're unaware of their condition. Now, the criminal law question is an important one, because I think if criminal law, if the balance isn't struck correctly, what it can do is send a really chilling message to people, particularly if there's over-criminalization of non-disclosure. Mm-hmm. This can send a signal to people, well, the last thing in the world I want to do is get an HIV test, because then in the event I'm HIV positive, this is going to open up disclosure obligations that might be very difficult for me personally, and then this might expose me to criminal liability. So the public health experts are very concerned about the over-criminalization of non-disclosure, leading both to increasing the stigma associated with HIV infection, but also deterring people from testing. Mm-hmm. And if we're deterring people from testing, we're not going to get to the end of the epidemic. So my approach to the whole question is really informed by this public health imperative that we've got to strike the right balance between, of course, criminal prosecution where it might be appropriate, where there's sort of an intentional, malicious intent to transmit HIV. Mm-hmm. But absent those extraordinary circumstances, if it's overly broadly interpreted, then the concern is that it sends this chilling effect and it enhances stigma and deters testing.
That's an interesting point you actually bring up, because kind of the leading criminal cases, at least, that we have on the topic, we have Currier, that was decided in 1998, and which is amended by R.V. Mabier in 2012. Yes. Neither of them bring in the fact whether the person who's infected has to be aware that they're infected or that they have this sort of disease. It never looks at that, which is actually quite problematic, because they only look at, whether there's a realistic possibility that HIV will be transmitted and how that can be reduced and what a realistic possibility really is. And so I think while these cases were decided well, when you look at them theoretically, kind of as facts on paper, they seem great. But again, like you mentioned, it doesn't alleviate the problem for those who don't know.
Yes. Well, first, I wouldn't say they're great.
Oh, perfect.
I would have a lot of concerns with both of the cases. And also, in the event that the accused is unaware of their status, mm-hmm. I don't think it could possibly give rise to a criminal charge.
Exactly.
Because there would be no non-disclosure in that case, because there would be no knowledge of their HIV infection. So again, if it's overly broadly interpreted, mm-hmm. the best thing you could say to a person, if you want to avoid criminal liability, do not get an HIV test, which of course is the worst possible message you want to send, both for their personal health, but also for the public health mm-hmm. perspective. I think what's important is that there's been a lot of evolution since those two cases, and in particular, the question of understanding what is the nature of the risk. Mm-hmm. And the court is clear in those cases that there needs to be some kind of significant risk of serious bodily harm, and recognizes mm-hmm. that as the scientific evidence on this advances, the view of what constitutes significant risks might change. And this is what is, I think, a particularly important statement. This is this expert consensus statement on the science of HIV in the context of criminal law. This was published in 2018 in the Journal of the International AIDS Society. So this is a state-of-the-art statement about what the nature of the risk of transmission is. And it cites the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, which is sort of the gold standard in terms of the science on the matter. And it describes the estimated possibility of HIV transmission from an HIV-positive person with an undetectable viral load mm-hmm. as a result of effective treatment as effectively no risk. So we now know that if someone is on treatment, there's effectively no risk, which means it could not possibly give rise to a criminal charge, because there would be no case to be made for a significant risk mm-hmm. of bodily harm. And so the Attorney General of Canada on World AIDS Day in December of this past year, she came out with a revised prosecutorial directives as to when it is appropriate to proceed with prosecution in these mm-hmm. cases. And this would apply to all federal prosecutions under the criminal code, which effectively really only means the North. And so they would have to have similar measures in place in each of the provinces. Mm-hmm. But I thought what the Attorney General, this was published in the Official Gazette on December 8th. And a couple of themes that the Attorney General outlines, I think, are very important. First, that HIV is first and foremost a public health issue. And so that goes to my earlier concern that we need to be thinking about this from a public health perspective, encouraging people to test, access to treatment, and so forth. Second, she says that the persons from marginalized backgrounds, particularly Indigenous, gay people, Black persons, are more likely to be living with HIV, and such that criminal law that apply to HIV disclosure may have a disproportionate impact on these groups. And third, the recent medical science on HIV transmission is key, and that the most recent medical science shows that the risk of transmission through sexual activity is significantly reduced when a person is on treatment, or condoms are used, or only oral sex is engaged in. So this is very important to understanding, going back to the earlier case, what constitutes a significant mm-hmm. risk. So in terms of the directives to prosecutors, the Attorney General directs as follows: that first, the director shall not prosecute HIV non-disclosure cases if the person living with HIV has maintained effective treatment and a suppressed viral load. So that will determine, and obviously I think similar guidelines should be adopted across the country. So that means that if a person is being successfully treated and has an undetectable viral load, there's no case for criminal charge. And that goes further than what we saw in the Courier case, or sorry, in Mabier case. There seemed to be, the court suggested that you needed both effective treatment with a low viral count and the use of a condom.
Yes.
So the science has advanced since that case, and indeed the Attorney General now recognizes that in the prosecution directive. Now, the second directive is the director shall generally not prosecute if condoms are used or it's only involved oral sex. So again, that recognizes that the risk in both of those cases is very low. Now, generally, one could contest that. The first directive is shall not prosecute in the event of effective treatment. One could say that there's also an equally low risk in the event of using condoms or engaging only in oral sex, and that's what the data you'll see in the science. But at any rate, that's an important advance as well. And then third provides that the director shall prosecute non-disclosure cases using non-sexual offenses instead of sexual offenses where it more appropriately reflects the lower level of blameworthiness. So again, a lot of the earlier cases, I think it was aggravated sexual assault.
It was, yes.
Which, of course, is a very serious charge, leading to registration of the sexual offenders and so forth. And so this was happening in the event where it was not clear there was a significant risk. And also, all of these, I think almost all of these cases, there was no actual transmission of HIV.
And that was the other problem. Yeah. Canada criminalizes only the risk of transmission and not actual transmission, which is also a bigger shift than some of the other jurisdictions, too, I believe.
Yeah, that is a big issue, of course, in Canada, and that the court is clear that there doesn't have to be transmission in order to give rise to a criminal charge. And likewise, the prosecutorial directives is also clear on that point. Now, a lot of people would contest that. They would say that the criminal application is only in there, is only appropriate when there's knowledge of one's status. There's an intentional disregard of the, obviously, non-disclosure, intentional, reckless disregard of the safety of the other person, and there's actually transmission. I mean, those are the cases where I think pretty much everyone agreed would merit criminal prosecution.
Absolutely.
Now, in the event there is no transmission, well, then I think it's, as you noted, the jurisdictions vary on this point. Canada, you're still liable for criminal prosecution. My own view is that that's going too far. I actually had an opportunity to discuss this with Justice Rothstein once because I think he was on the case. I said to him, why not secure a remedy in tort in that case? And there's non-disclosure. There may be mental distress associated with that, and there could be a recovery in tort. But why use criminal law in the event that there's been no actual transmission, given the seriousness of the consequences to the individual? I think it's a bit of overkill. That would be my concern. And again, the extent to which this is over-criminalized raises all of the other concerns that I've mentioned about deterring testing and the larger impact on public health. But I think all of this is to say, with these kinds of advances in these directives to prosecutors, I think the Canadian law has significantly evolved from what you see in these earlier cases.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing.
Considering you mentioned there was much wrong with the decision in the two cases.
Well, yes, I think the Carrier decision and the Mabier decision really misstated the nature of the risk.
Oh.
Now,
absolutely.
Mind you, these were earlier decisions, and the science on this has advanced, but the science is not very clear, particularly around treatment. And this then goes back to my starting point that expanding access to treatment is the way that we're going to end the epidemic. We're not going to get there unless we encourage people to test. Anything that places barriers to testing is a problem.
So it almost seems like this criminalization of the risk, while may have had on some level an intention of deterring people from non-disclosure, is actually having the opposite effect of people not getting tested because of.
Yes.
So it's kind of going in the opposite direction that we want it to.
Well, again, I think these advances are important because they will significantly reduce the numbers of prosecutions. Because Canada had the dubious distinction of being one of the countries that had the highest numbers of prosecutions per capita of anywhere in the world. And so we had a very aggressive criminalization of non-disclosure. I think this has now been a very concentrated campaign to get this to change. The Attorney General of Canada's guidelines, I think, are out front on this. Likewise, in Ontario, there's similar guidelines. These are the Ontario prosecutorial guidelines as of December 1st, 2017, that likewise state that if a person is on antiretroviral therapy and suppressed viral load, there's no realistic possibility of transmission. So in those circumstances, charges will not proceed. So that's good news. That's good news for the public health aspect. Yeah.
So I guess I'm moving forward. Changes that I guess would make this even better is, given the scientific advances, we should maybe move away from criminalizing the risk, since it seems to be very, very low regardless, and move to criminalizing just the actual transmission of HIV if it is transmitted.
Yes, I think for criminal prosecution, one, there would have to be knowledge that a person was HIV positive. There would have to be a deliberate non-disclosure, malicious intent to transmit the infection, and actually transmitting the infection. I think all of that, there's no question that would give rise to criminal liability. But in the absence of any of those factors, I think for me, the question is, how does criminal law advance?
Yes.
The larger objective here, which is, of course, this is the objective, to end the HIV epidemic.
Exactly, yeah.
And I'm not sure that criminal law advances that. And in particular, the threat of criminal prosecution, even in the absence of the actual transmission. Mm-hmm. Is this deterring this kind of behavior?
Yeah.
I doubt it. That kind of behavior is deeply antisocial, if indeed it involves that kind of malicious intent. Is it sending a chilling signal around testing? That's my concern, and enhancing stigma associated with HIV.
That's fair.
Yeah.
In terms of getting treatment and getting to the point of being no risk, like, how onerous is that? How long does it require you're taking treatment for? Does it kind of vary? It seems as though, as long as you have the proof that, in the criminal context, as long as you have the proof that you are seeking treatment, you know what's going on, and the risk is now significantly or statistically insignificant, how onerous is it to get to that point to where you're able to say, like, no, I'm not a danger, and there shouldn't be any sort of presumption against just me as a person?
I mean, the good news is the treatment is highly effective, and that's been demonstrated by significant clinical evidence now. And so if a person is being treated and is being monitored to determine that they're successfully being treated in terms of viral load, the outcomes are really outstanding, nothing short of miraculous in terms of how far this has come in terms of the treatment of HIV. And the response to the treatment is very fast, remarkably fast. I mean, it's one of the great medical stories of the century, is that we've been able to provide effective treatment for HIV. So if a person is being treated, most of the treatment is highly successful. Now, the person needs to comply with the treatment. Mm-hmm. There has to, you know, if there's uneven compliance, it's not going to be effective. And it's not a particularly onerous regime. There would be a course of treatment every day that you would have to take. I mean, the simplest, newest ones are one pill a day, and you're good to go.
Take with your vitamins.
And now, sometimes the regime might be a bit more complex, depending on the nature of where, you know, a person's condition, but on the whole, highly effective. And indeed, this is, again, what we're focusing on here, is that we can, what we've identified in the existing research is there's 9,000 people in Canada who remain undiagnosed. There's 10,000 people who are diagnosed but not on treatment, which is a concern, because these are people who, for whatever reason, are not accessing the treatment that is available.
Are there barriers to accessing the treatment that might be impacting them?
Yes, a lot. I think primarily the barriers would be in here. It may be people who, for whatever reason, are unable to access the care that they need. It might be their own personal circumstances. There may be some drug and alcohol issues here. There may be other reasons why mental health mm-hmm. issues, why they're not able to access the treatments. The treatments are available free of charge anywhere in Canada. So it's not a, you know, if you need assistance in order to access these treatments, mm-hmm. that is available. So again, this is something we focused on in our work. Why are there so many people who are not yet getting the treatment that they need? And then of those being treated, there's 91% of the people in Canada who are being treated have achieved suppression of the virus. Wow. So that's how effective the treatment is if people comply.
Amazing. Yeah. So I guess the takeaway is maybe step away so much from criminalizing and move more towards awareness and trying to figure out more proactive ways of getting people to either get tested or figure out how we can get people to seek treatment more better so we can end the issue as opposed to kind of criminalizing the people who just have to live with this.
Yeah, reduce the barriers to testing.
Reduce the barriers.
Enhance access to treatment. And we know it will be highly effective in bending the curve on new infections. So naturally, I think that's where we should be focusing the bulk of our efforts. The criminal law will have a role in the egregious, very small number of egregious cases that I've mentioned. But the criminal law has no major role in the public health objective. And as I've said earlier, if it is too aggressively applied, it actually becomes highly detrimental to the public health. The public health priorities.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to meet with us.
I'm happy to help. It was good to do this because I've actually been invited by a parliamentary committee to talk about this on Tuesday.
There we go. A good little
precursor.
They gave me a little kick in the pants to do my research
Perfect.
In advance.
Excellent.
That's it for today's episode. Pro Bono Radio is brought to you by Queen's Faculty of Law, Pro Bono Students Canada, and with the generous support of CFRC, Queen's Campus Community Radio Station, broadcasting at 101.9 FM and online at cfrc.ca. The show was written and produced by the students of Queen's Law and is intended for entertainment purposes only. We are not lawyers. Nothing contained in the episode should be considered as legal advice. If you are in need of legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Pro Bono Radio is recorded at Queen's University, situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory.